Hey, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Wallace Hartley, the podcast presents. I'm your host, Glenn Lamont, along with my co-host, Paul Chartier. And how are you this fine evening? Everything good?
I'm doing well. I'm excited about this. It's nice having a guest. It's nice not having to listen to ourselves on the podcast, but also it's because it's a subject that I'm really looking forward to getting more informed about. It's I don't think there's a lot of folks that are familiar with exactly what's going on, so that I'm really looking forward to, and I'm really glad we had somebody here that's like willing to talk to us about this. So a warm welcome, Kabir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, listen, we're thrilled. First of all, I'm thrilled anytime anybody agrees to be a guest on this show, let alone somebody who actually has something to say. So let's head right into it. So our topic this evening is something that, you know, is, as Paul said, of great importance. I don't think we hear enough about it. I think it's one of those things that comes up in the news once in a while, and people are, you know, oh my God, that's horrible. And then they go back to scrolling through their phones, probably an iPhone made in China. So, you know what I mean? So some say we are currently teetering on the brink of World War III. Russia has invaded Ukraine, and the world is watching as innocent civilians are being slaughtered because another despot has decided that he'll have what he wants at all costs. Only this time, the stakes are extremely high as Vladimir Putin has his finger on a button that controls upwards of 5,977 nuclear warheads, of which around 4,500 are considered strategic, which means they can be fired over long distances. What makes this war different than all the others? Well, it's become quite clear that Ukraine is a majority white population. And as one CBS News foreign correspondent so blatantly pointed out, Ukraine isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European city where you wouldn't expect that to happen. In short, they look and act just like us, so we need to sit up and pay attention. On any given day all around the globe, innocent civilians, women and children, old and young, are being slaughtered by authoritarian regimes on a daily basis. The only difference is that they're people of color, and so little is done about it. They are Palestinian, African, Asian, and Muslim. They are people who have done nothing to deserve the violence perpetrated against them other than being brown, black, or the wrong religion, according to whatever dictator or warlord has decided that they are a threat. Now, for the first time in a long time, the Western world is associating the word refugee with people who are white. And yet they still don't seem to make the connection with all the conflicts happening in other countries. They cannot see past themselves. However, wherever there is oppression, there is also activism. And activism means hope. Underground movements have gone hand in hand with revolution since we've become so-called civilized nations. The current quiet revolution that's becoming louder by the day concerns the Uyghur genocide in China. And since the start of the Cultural Revolution in China, violence and oppression has been common, and the rest of the world has done little to oppose it. Even as China's recently hosted the 2022 Winter Olympics, and many nations decided to make their opposition known by diplomatic boycotts, this meant not sending any government officials, but they would send athletes. The question should be not why didn't everyone just outright boycott the games, but why was China allowed to host it in the first place? The PRC has proven time and again that they care for nothing for individual rights and freedoms, as is evident in Tibet and more recently in Hong Kong. But the most horrific abuses seem to have been reserved for the Uyghur people themselves, whose main threat to the Chinese government seems to be their sense of cultural autonomy and occupying ancestral lands. The approach taken by China is very similar to the one Canada took and continues to take with the indigenous people here, and has led China to accuse Canada of the kettle calling the pot black, and for good reason. China is a huge trading partner for Canada and many other countries, so no one is too eager to rattle their cage very hard. Some finger pointing, a diplomatic boycott, and the odd sanction are about the extent of the condemnation. So how can we make a difference? And, you know, it's auspicious that today is the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And joining us today is someone who can hopefully tell us how we can make a difference. Born in Almaty, Kazakhstan, a year after his parents fled Xinjiang following a government crackdown in 1997. He holds a degree in molecular biology and is currently finishing up his Bachelor of Education at Simon Fraser University. He's an activist, writer, and filmmaker, and he currently resides right here in Vancouver, BC, where he teaches high school. Kabir is also the founder of the Score for Rights campaign to raise awareness of the Uyghur genocide at the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing, China. Please welcome to the program, Kabir Kurban.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. I can't thank you enough for being here, Kabir. And before we jump in with the serious stuff, you need to tell us, what is more dangerous? Being Uyghur and an outspoken critic of the People's Republic of China, or being a teacher?
It depends on what age group you teach. It really depends. I actually did finish up, luckily, my education degree earlier in December. Mm-hmm. Now I could probably say I am a certified teacher here in Surrey.
Before
I claim any other title. I love it out here. But before I even consider myself an activist or anything else, I would like the people out there to know me as a high school teacher. Because for too often have the Muslim people really been victimized and said, oh yeah, they're activists or they're victims or they're refugees. No, I'm a high school teacher who happens to be Uyghur, and out of the necessity that my community needs, I had to step up a little bit and speak up against the CCP regime.
So we started hearing about detention camps and forced labor and things like that back in like around 2017, 2018. You yourself have said that at least 30 of your relatives are being held or are in danger of being sent to forced labor camps.
I have 30 family members who I have no idea of their whereabouts.
Wow.
That's the gist of it. I wish I could say that they're free. I wish if they were locked up, I wish I knew. But it's just I have zero information of their whereabouts, their livelihood, their children, nothing of the sorts since 2016.
Wow. And at what point did you decide to speak out, to become the activist that we know you as today? Mm-hmm.
It was a gradual change, I would say. There was always a bone in me that wasn't really content with the fact that I'm not home, right? I'm visibly different. I came here and I didn't speak English. I was an outsider for a long time, and I wasn't welcomed all the time, whether it be in the schools, in the communities. So a sense of my own identity was always missing. And the Chinese government has been slowly oppressing my people, not to the extent that which they started in 2016 by sending off millions of my fellow Uyghurs to concentration camps. They would start off with closing down the Uyghur schools, then slowly oppressing on religion, slowly getting men to to shave their beards, to force kids who are going to schools during Ramadan to break their fasts with pork. When this news started reaching me, I just entered adulthood, and I started to make my own decisions in life. And I remember it was June of 2020 when I really had to make a decision. The news has got to me that one of my cousins, my first cousin, my father's sister's son, as cousin as it gets, he was taken away. He was taken to a camp on two terms, and then he was released, and only to be arrested indefinitely and arbitrarily. And he's, to this day, I have no idea where his whereabouts are. And I had to really sit down and make that decision, right? Because I am a religious person, and I fear the day that I have to testify in front of my God, and he says, I gave you the information of your cousin, and you did nothing, right? Me being the religious man, I don't want to stand in front of my Lord and testify and say, no, I didn't do anything. So here we are, fighting strong and doing our best, as best as a high school teacher can do.
Well, I tell you, I'm really curious from what I've read about what's going on over there. And of course, we have, Paul, you mentioned earlier, we have a very odd relationship with China here in Canada. Well, you said it was odd. I wouldn't have been as nice.
We have deep history. Like, it's more, I don't think a lot of people know how connected Canada and China is. So, the stuff I learned about, it was a book called Claws of the Panda. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was by a Canadian journalist that lived in Hong Kong for a long time and wrote the business section. One of the unique features about Canadian history is many people in very senior positions in foreign affairs in Canada, in the Liberal Party of Canada, in the 50s and 60s, grew up as children in China as the sons of Methodist missionaries. So they were fluent in Mandarin and Cantonese, and they were very familiar with the culture. So when Mao came to power, and he screwed everything up with the collectivization and there was the famine, there were weather issues and other things too, but similar to what happened in Ukraine, there was like a collectivization effort and it failed. So a lot of people went hungry because basically they took the food from the countryside and sent it to urban centers, just like Stalin did in Ukraine. That famine actually went underground for a long time. Like, it was not known in the West till probably the late 70s, early 80s, when information was coming out about that. Canada was one of the first Western nations to send wheat to China because of that. And it was because of those relationships. So we've also had very strong cultural exchanges since then. And so that's what I'm really curious about, because I know the strategy in the west of China is what struck me about it. And I haven't learned a lot, but what struck me about it was just how similar it was to like the efforts in Canada to destroy indigenous culture. So here's an indigenous. 100%. Yeah. Here's an indigenous group with their identity is tied to the land, like the area where they are from, right? But the entire strategy is what Canada did, except using high technology, which I thought made it really frightening, because it's like...
I really wanted to get into that, and I'm glad you opened up that topic. China is a master copycat. Whether it be trying to find their hands on U.S. military equipment and trying to re-engineer it, to the systematic oppression of a people, when you look at what they did in Canada to the indigenous populations all over, and what they are doing to the Uyghur people, it is from the exact playbook. To the point where they are trying to mix the ethnicities forcefully, sending Han Chinese military men to live in individuals' households, similarly to how certain populations of mixed indigenous people were formed, to the point where the residential schools are very common and very prevalent in East Turkestan. I like to say East Turkestan, not as an independence movement, right? I don't believe in fighting independence at this point. I think we need to fight for human rights first, and then maybe if the conversation opens up, we can talk about that. But at this point, I see the word East Turkestan as a symbolic homage, similarly to how right now I say that I am on the unceded territories of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and the Katsia people. One day I would hope that the Chinese populations that enter the so-called X word, the Xinjiang land, would acknowledge the fact that they are on stolen East Turkestan Uyghur territory. So thank you for opening up that topic.
Well, it's
a very sophisticated approach. Like I've read just a little bit from an SFU professor, Professor Dylan, I think. I can't remember his name, but he wrote a few articles, and he's written some books.
He just wrote a book about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, it's about, Tyler. Are you familiar with him?
I think I am. Let me search up his name. Yeah. Dr. Darren Byler.
Yeah, Byler. That's it.
Yeah. He's a recent scholar at Simon Fraser.
Yeah. And what he was mentioning, like some things really fascinated me, like looking at a train wreck kind of fascination. So one of the things they did early days, which I wanted to talk to you about, is they made it mandatory for Uyghurs to have cell phones. Mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the connection to like Western tech companies and the security features that they're coming up with. And often that's a characteristic, unfortunately, of Western capitalism and its sort of long history of colonialism is we'll often test things that are coming to like our home country soon in other places. We'll get other, you know, dictators and others to do the dirty work, test it out, work out the bugs, and then they'll apply kind of a kinder, gentler North American veneer. I mean, you've lived in Canada and in the West for a while now, and you can see it, right? When you're from someplace else, that's one of the beauties about living in Canada is you meet people from all over the world. And what a lot of people from all over the world say is like, we do a lot of awful things, but in a very, like we got really good PR and we've got a kind of a kinder, gentler way of like pitching it. And, you know, it's like an abuser who minimizes his abuse, like to his partner or whatever. It's like, oh, it's not that bad. And they're just complaining and they're whining. And like, it's those kind of elements. Right. So I'm just really curious about any information you might want to share about sort of how the very holistic pattern of control was slowly put into place. Because like you said, it started slow. And then it just became like this complete containment with this very powerful technological backup to monitor people.
Right.
And when you were talking about not knowing where people were, my understanding of the situation is you're going to put people at risk if you try to contact them.
Yes,
that's how controlled it is. So,
especially now with the stance that I have made earlier in my career, I'd say when I was, you know, in 2016, I was not an outspoken activist. I was just... I had the intention of going to, you know, university. I was a 19-year-old kid. I wasn't really worried about all these complexities of life. But as the time went on and I did more research, the news was shocking that every 7 square meters in East Turkestan, and I will continue to use this term, is surveyed by CCTV. And now, as this technology progresses, this facial recognition software that exists, you know, it is very alarming. The way I live right now here in Surrey, and if I was to go to Coquitlam, let's say, for a shift, for an on-call shift, I would have had to go through a checkpoint over the bridge to get into New Westminster. I would have had to get a checkpoint on the border of New Westminster and Coquitlam. Just every single time I crossed those little municipal lines. People are not allowed to just freely roam. They're not even allowed to maintain their own passports. They have to apply every single time to look at their passports, wherever it is they want to go. And the government is tracking every single one of them. It's not that they just have to have a phone. It's that they have to have a certain set of applications that will... one of them for their quote-unquote health tracker, right? They're doing it for our favor. Here's your health app to make sure everything's up to date, right? And then another app for their finances, another app, and they are not allowed to get rid of these apps. If you delete them, then guess what? The government authorities will knock on your door and say, hey, by the way, is everything okay with you? We're just making sure that, you know, you're healthy, just checking up, you know, a police officer, of course, and just making sure you're healthy. So it is a very doctrinal way of thinking. And the way that China does it is inch by inch, because nobody will complain about an inch. Nobody will complain about a centimeter, to the point where people maybe start noticing the mile which they have been approached by. And then they say, hold up, stop. And China will stop. They say, OK, no problem. You know what? Maybe we did outstep, until the media stays quiet, until there is another thing to that people jump on, until Kim Kardashian starts dancing for some reason again. And then guess what? The media stops thinking about them. Then they start inching again, inch by inch by inch, because there is an agenda. And we cannot deny the fact that they have not reached their full agenda, right? There, no nation wants to be number five. You know, every nation wants to exceed and exceed until the point they are maximized their potential. And China is doing just that. And their goal is not a 5-year, 1-year goal. No, they are here for a quote unquote a long time. So they will keep inching until they get what they want.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, when we were talking earlier, I was also going to mention, I guess our freedom rally here in Ottawa must have given you a good laugh.
And oh, my goodness. I'm a scientist, right? I studied molecular biology, and I do believe in the efficacy of vaccines. I'm going to put that out there. But I do believe in the freedom of everybody doing whatever the heck they want to do, right? It is important that we uphold those values, right? Like I said, and I'm not trying to sound like a tinfoil hat guy, I'm a religious dude, right? And unfortunately, in this day and age, religion has been equated with hocus pocus. And I'm not even allowed to have a point of view about anything now, right? Everything is given to me, whether it is in my classroom, whether it is how I vote. All these ideas are forced down my throat. And I believe in vaccine. I'm double vaxxed, but I don't believe that everybody should force. I know people that in Canada, right, traumatized through the healthcare system, individuals who were lied about the injections they were received, you know, and they were sterilized. This has happened in our own nation, where people who got tested on a lower IQ back in the 80s, they were sterilized against their will and against their information. Right? I'm not saying that Pfizer and BioNTech is out here trying to sterilize the population, but the people who were traumatized, they deserve the freedom to not inject themselves.
Oh, and this still happens. It's still common with Indigenous women in this country to be sterilized against their will. Several have been, and there are lawsuits happening right now. And, you know, it's a slippery slope. But I had to poke fun at, you know, the hillbillies who went to Ottawa just because it's fun and it's easy.
Their freedoms are being attacked. I'm like, sir, you're allowed, you're driving a semi truck across a nation, enjoying your view on the way there, getting fed by donors. There's no reason for
pretty much
complain.
Yeah. You know, Kabir, I first heard or became aware of you and the Score for Rights campaign when I saw you being interviewed by Chemi Lamo, I guess on her Instagram. And yeah, that's right, I follow people on Instagram. I'm not that old.
Wow. And Chemi Lamu, what a woke person you are, Glenn Lamont.
Well, I was pretty, I first read about her when she, I don't know whether she got elected for student body president or it was vice president at the University of Toronto. And then all these death threats started coming her way. And near as we can figure, they came, you know, probably from like Chinese students who are here in Canada under pressure from the state. And that's a pretty, that's pretty terrifying. It's pretty terrifying that, you know, people can be put under that kind of pressure, be threatened like that, to threaten another person who's done nothing to them in the first place. I mean, that alone, you know, and I've heard of similar stories with, you know, there's that touring dance company, Shen Yi, and of course that's part of Falun Gong.
Yeah,
and
it is.
Same kind of thing. You know, people who produce and promote these shows get a visit one day, and the next thing you know, the show gets a call from the theater going, yeah, you know what, sorry, we can't book you, sorry. And, you know, you got to move on. So they're here, and they have that ability in Canada. That's a little bit scary.
Just last week at Cornell University, an Uyghur woman got being yelled at, you know, being threatened by Chinese students. And here, even in BC, I was part of panels, and people stepped down from the panel because I was speaking alongside them.
Really?
Right. And yes.
You know, and
I was going to ask you about that because it's a strategy of the Communist Party since the late 50s, early 60s. So as soon as there was access, I really liked some comments you made in the very beginning of this, where like you referenced that, like, China really plays the long game, right? So they don't do things with like a 5-year, they have 5-year plans, but their international influence strategy is based on like 50, 75-year, 100-year plans, where they...
Mm-hmm. That's why these supreme leaders are so important to them.
Yeah.
They make a doctrine and they say, I have put this in place and it will go on for eternity. Right.
Yeah.
Whether it be with Mao, he put in some things that to this day are still being played out. Now with Xi Jinping earlier this summer, he claimed himself to be a supreme leader, and he has plans that he's trying to put forward in the next 50 years.
Yeah. And he's actually implementing them. Like, he's, this guy does what he says. So one of the things that is really intriguing that I've learned about is part of the long game always has been to, have as many people as possible that are like loyal and nationalist, like loyal to Han Chinese, right? In higher education. So you said earlier as well, this is a place that's very adept at actually like learning technology and copying it and improving it. And now part of the strategy, one of the 5-year plans is to actually, they want to move from copying to developing their own technology and their own high-tech technology. But they've actually had like about a 30-year network of overseas Chinese students, ones that are like party loyalists and stuff. So it's not like every single person is like a spy or anything. Some are hardcore and some are actually there as actual intelligence gatherers, and they do what they can. I mean, countries spy on each other, especially like industrial espionage and, you know, like the new high-tech development. That's a key area for espionage around the world. But the Chinese also try to do like cultural influence, and also they may not have people that are actually working for the party, but they want nationalists that are loyal to China and are more loyal to China than they are to where they're going to school. And they use that orientation. It's kind of like, you know, Americans in the 50s that like went to Russia on exchanges and stuff like that, right? They were American. Like they like thought America was the best thing since sliced bread, and there's no way you could convince them and all that kind of stuff. And just, you know, they weren't necessarily spies, but they would be out amongst people in the Soviet Union and just saying how great America was and that sort of thing, right? And that's similar to this strategy that the Chinese have had for a long, long time. And they purposely, like, would identify people to actually send to like major universities in all the sort of Western nations. And they would target universities based on what they want to learn about. So like they would go to some Midwestern university in the United States if they wanted to learn more about like, you know, raising hogs or, you know, like whatever they needed, they would send people with a specific, like, learn about this, bring it back to China, that kind of thing, right? So you use those kind of relationships and that support where you're getting state support to go and get that benefit, right? And they use that to have like people have a sense of loyalty so that if they ask them to do something a little bit odd that's not to do with pig farming, they're like, sure, I'll check that out, right? So it's not like spying, but it's like promoting nationalism. So where you're from, part of the strategy is like you talked about like them sending men, right? They advertise to single men to go there to marry Uyghur women. Like that's it's a cultural strategy to reduce Uyghur culture, right?
And it's against our religion to have women alone with another man, like that's not their husband in their own household, right? And in some weird cultural, like I guess appreciation, I would say the Chinese men, they have this thing where that they do is after they enjoy your meal, it's like if you show your stomach and it's bulging out, it's like, oh yeah, I very much enjoyed your meal. And to us Uyghurs, this is like absolutely like barbaric. You know, we were not accustomed to this type of culture. And then it's they're not just there to, you know, to eat our food. They're there to monitor. And it's very evident, you know, they are not, if they see any signs of a Quran, any spaces dedicated to prayer, any symbol, if they see an extra knife in your household, right, the government allots you your set of knives, and you're not allowed to have more knives than that. Imagine that. Your shovels, all of the tools are documented by the government. And if you have a surplus, or if you have less, they'll question you. They say, where did you give it to? Who did you give it to? Why don't you have it? And the so-called, you know, I don't know, I forget the name that they gave them. I'm just gonna call them, like, you know, spies, because that's what they do. The spies on these households, they're not fully aware of their own espionage, like you said. They're given a task. They're not told that they are spies, right? But there's a lot of these other things that come with it. The fact that they have their phone on their side, right? Everybody's a spy nowadays. You may not even know it, right? Somebody could just bug somebody's phone and boom, the conversation is recorded. So it is a very, very tricky situation to navigate around.
And we just saw Canada in a situation that it probably didn't think it would find itself in, because on the one hand, this was with the whole Huawei Meng Wanzhou debacle, because here they had America, the United States, saying, "Hey, we need you guys to do this." Now, I've always looked upon the United States as it's like living next door to a drunk neighbor with a lot of guns, essentially. Really annoying, but you don't want to piss them off too much. So when the U.S. came and said, "We need you to do this," Canada broke all kinds of laws when they detained Meng Wanzhou. I'm no fan of Huawei, but you know, when you want to talk about rights and freedoms, they did a pretty piss poor job. And then at the same time, we had two Canadian citizens thrown in jail in China, and nobody was standing up for them.
Yeah, two Michaels.
Yeah. Like, it blew me away.
And they never said that it was related, right? They just said, "Oh no, they were performing. They were treasonous." And then as soon as we release, you know, the CFO, guess what? They released the Michaels. What a coincidence!
I know, and I mean, it was pretty. It must have been just horrible for Trudeau, who's pretty spineless to begin with, to have been. It's like, I don't know what to do. I mean, I know people hate me, but it's like, who's going to hate me less? And that was an amazing thing to see. Canada, you know, as I said before, has that kind of relationship with not just China, but many countries where, again, what it really boils down to, if there's something in it for us, you know, we're going to let things slide. And as you talked about earlier, you know, it doesn't start, you know, with these draconian measures, bang, bang, one after the other. And of course, we only need to look at very recent history. And I know people freak out when you use this example, but we just have to look at Germany in 1929. And when you ask people who have lived through that, you know, German people, you know, and you say, how did you let that happen? It's almost exactly the same. And it's always a case of, well, you know, first of all, you know, it's not going to happen to me. So it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. But it's also like you said, it's just, oh, it's just a little thing. It's not that big a deal. And then before you know it, you know, hey, where did everybody go? And Canada seems to be quite complicit just by our own apathy, by the way they looked at the two Michaels and kind of went, yeah, we don't know what they did, but they're in jail and, you know, we're going to try and get them out instead of just calling it what it was. You know, it was completely a hostage situation. And there's one thing that I feel, and I know you have, you're going to need a minute here, Kabir, but I just want to put this in your head. Now, since COVID started back in 2020, there has been, as you know, an unprecedented number of violent attacks on Asian people here in Canada and the U.S. Ex-bonehead President Trump and others referred to it as Kung Flu. People blamed China, but didn't really blame China. They, you know, they blamed anybody who looked Asian. And I guess so. You know, how do we find a balance between holding China accountable for this horrendous genocide against Uyghur people, and not adding to the already rampant racist anti-Asian sentiments that are so prevalent today here in the West?
Mm-hmm. One logical fallacy that exists among everyone, I would say, is media has allowed us to associate a government's wrongdoings to its people, right? And vice versa, right? It, like the truckers' protest has been equated with the Canadian people. Mm. And also the Canadian government, in a sense, right? They're completely different things, right? And when we say that, you know, when Trump goes around saying Kung Flu, people associate the individuals, right? The Chinese citizens, not even the Chinese, the Koreans even get fed up with this. It's just like when Islamophobia was rampant after 9/11, a lot of Sikhs were being attacked for no apparent reason. They were like, what are we getting in trouble for? Right, so it's the media's fault for not ensuring that, you know, that the separation of these identities is not, and we shouldn't, like, I'll be the first to say, you know, CCP is disgusting what they do, the Chinese regime, and I make sure that I always say the government, right? Because Xi Jinping and, you know, my mom's friends are different people. You know, they, I have a lot of Han Chinese people coming up to me genuinely like apologizing for some reason as if they did something. I said, no, don't feel wrong. I appreciate your support, right? And I'm glad that you stand with me in standing against the CCP government, right? It is the government, not the people. It's just like, you know, and I'll use this example too, the terrorists, so that, you know, these brown terrorists, it's them. But you've never seen them. You just, you might have seen, you know, Abu Bakr, who gives you your bread at the Safeway, right? And he's not the same person as Bashar al-Assad, right? These are completely different beings, entities, and we need to treat them for what they are. These are government organizations and the population who unfortunately also suffer by that same hand, right? Who are also complaining, right? We could all work together. Right. The what we don't see in the West here is internal Chinese matters. Right. We all think that everyone, oh, well, if the CCP is getting away with all of this, then that means the Chinese citizens are supporting them. Well, they are supporting the government in the sense that the Chinese government is doing a good job in maintaining the power. Right. They're economically speaking, they're quite advanced, quite smart, you know, and I have to give it up to them. The way they deal with money is very smart. Like the way they trap people in debt is ingenious. It's disgusting, but it's ingenious, right? And some of the Chinese people, they're in love with that because for too long have the Chinese people actually suffered from being a developing nation. But that, you know, their economic strategies and their human rights concerns are also very different things. Right. I am anti-CCP because they are inflicting a genocide on my people, because they are fueling the army in Burma to killing the Myanmar population, because they are, you know, shaking hands with Taliban behind closed doors. Right. These are the reasons why I'm against the CCP, not because, you know, I was somebody, some Chinese person looked at me the wrong way and all of a sudden I'm going after the Chinese government. No, these are completely two different things. I'm glad that you brought that up.
Well, you know, when we talk about indigenous people's rights to self-determination and self-government, do you think countries like Canada and the U.S. are starting to understand this and accept this? Or is most of what they do just performative allyship?
It takes steps, you know, to climb a mountain. And we have only been seeing land acknowledgements come into the, like, Vancouver, like in Canada, I would say. Land acknowledgements in Canada have only started to become more prevalent, I'd say, 5 years ago, max. You know, 6-7 years ago, if you made a land acknowledgement, people would laugh. Like, who is this guy? Right. So to see those steps come into place, to see these areas and spaces being offered, is a step in the right direction, right? And we should continue with these steps. We should have dialogue. We can't just say, okay, the government of Canada, who's majority white men, they shouldn't be just saying, oh yeah, we figured out this is how the indigenous people are going to enjoy their lives. Let's give them all of this. No. Have dialogue. Have conversation. Include the people in their own reform, right? You cannot just say, oh yeah, we figured out this is the reconciliation aspect of it. Here you go, enjoy. No. Let the indigenous people decide what reconciliation really means, right? And allow it to take time. We, you know, don't mess it up. You know, make sure that you are showing that you are putting effort, but you don't have to force it within a week. Right, because then you'll just slip up and you'll make weird mandates, and next thing you know, a whole bunch of people are complaining again. Take the steps, be patient, and have a genuine approach at trying to, you know, get through to reconciliation.
I have one quick question to end things off. You've been in here in Canada for a while now, and this is probably the most important question. Baseball or hockey?
Rugby.
Oh, thank God. All right. We'll let you go. You can get away with that one. People think I'm some sort of, you know, Canadian hating guy because I'm not a hockey fan. As a matter of fact, you say you don't like hockey here in Canada. They may actually try and ship you off to China.
Yeah.
Kabir?
And China will take you because then they'll put you on their Olympic team. They'll
don't even get me started on that. That was funny. Kabir Karan, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the program here on Wallace Hartley Presents the podcast. Amazing story. I hope we can catch up in the future and see where you're at. Mm-hmm. And once again, folks, you know, you can check this guy out on your, you have a website.
I do have a website, kabirkurban@gmail.com. If you want to email me, then it's at gmail.com. But my website is just my first name, last name.com. You can find me on Instagram at jokabir, Joe Kabir. My Twitter is kabirkurban. I'm pretty out there. You search up my name, speech to text, you'll probably find something.
Awesome. Well, thanks again. And thank all of you for tuning in. Next time, right here on the Wallace Hartley Presents. Later, everybody.